Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Nadia, where are you calling from in the world?
I am calling from Brighton by the seaside. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, why? Why, oh, my goodness?
I was a student in Brighton many years ago, and now a close family member is a student in Brighton.
Right.
I took him out for drinks at the Basket Makers.
Right. I'm still getting to know it. If I look out of my window and really squint, I can just about see the sea. And that's a really nice thing to do. So I sit here, days out to sea, and miss all my book deadlines.
Ah, the best of all possible. I've been doing that for years.
Yeah, it's great.
John, you're not calling from your usual Oxfordshire, are you?
No, I'm in Stillington in North Yorkshire. I'm looking out. Well, I'm not actually. I've got my back to the Hawardian Hills, which are It's very beautiful. It's very near Castle Howard.
Castle Howard, please.
Castle Howard. Ah, sorry. I forgot. We've just done South Riding. I'm more or less in South Riding. If South Riding was a real place, this is more or less where it would be. So
our magnificent Yorkshire accents just won't quit, listeners. Still.
Oh, was that meant to be Yorkshire? Was that yours? Sorry, I didn't realise.
I'm very much afraid it was, yes.
Okay. Do a lot of people write letters in?
And Raymond Briggs lives near Brighton, doesn't he?
My understanding is he lives in a village called West Meston, which is probably about a 15-minute drive from where I am. So after this, I'm going to go round with some cakes.
Are you? That's very nice of you. Go and tell him we all think he's great. He'll love that.
I will. I probably won't get very close to the front door, but you know.
He was certainly living there in 2015 when we filmed the film that we made for Notes from the Sofa in his amazing ramshackle house. I mean, his most incredible house full of stuff. It's, and full of stuff that you recognise from the books as well, which is particularly exciting.
Well, the view out the window of his studio is the view that you can see in several of the books, including Somewhat Looking the Worst for Wear in When the Wind Blows.
Oh, blimey.
Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us deep underground in a damp and oozy land of muck and grime. We've just put on our deliciously wet and filthy vest and trousers and are pulling on boots full of groom and gleet. We're about to set off through the dimly lit tunnels towards the top to indulge in some howf, hopefully involving glyphs, flays, horripilations, and if we're lucky, boils. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And today we're joined by a new guest and an old favourite, Nadia Shireen and Andrew Mayle. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. New guest Nadia Shireen is a children's book author and illustrator. She mainly works in the picture book format, but has recently moved into making middle grade books, the ones with black and white drawings in. I didn't know what that was. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I thought I'd better underline what that was.
Thank you. With a new series called Grimwood. She used to work in magazines as a sub-editor, most notably for Smash Hits just before it folded.
Yep, true story.
How does your work on Smash Hits influenced your current work?
It's influenced it really directly, actually, because I worked on, I was a sub-editor, so I was putting together, you know, helping to put together the magazine. So I was learning about image and text and funny captions. And I had an education in kind of on-the-job education in graphic design and editing. And it really, really has informed how I work.
Yeah.
On another level, just the way that I write and kind of the silly words that I sometimes use. One of my picture books is called The Bumble Bear. And there's a page in The Bumble Bear where a load of bees are surprised at something. And they all say, "What the jiggins?" And I wasn't sure where I got "what the jiggins" from. And then one day I was leafing through a back issue of Smash Hits, as I'm wont to do of an evening.
Yeah.
And I found a feature from like 1986 or 87. And it said, "What the jiggins is Morrissey going on about now?" And I thought, oh, there you go. Yeah.
Nadja is also a true backlisted friend because she is a massive Pet Shop Boys fan and she lives in Brighton with two indifferent cats. That's what we require from all true backlisted fans. Meanwhile, our old favourite guest, who to use the argo of Smash Hits is back, his official friend of the show, Andrew Mayle.
Yay!
Hello!
Yay!
Andrew is making his 9th appearance on Backlisted. Oh,
goodness me.
As well as all 6 of our Halloween episodes, Andrew has previously joined us to talk about Norwood's Raymond Chandler and Salisbury's William Golding. He's a celebrated arts journalist and books nut, the senior associate editor at Mojo Magazine, and writes regularly on music, books, film, art, TV, architecture, clothes, especially hats.
He's just making it up now. God bless him.
He is the Big Issues hat correspondent.
Had no idea that was him.
I'm still waiting for my first column. They haven't got back to me. They promised.
Yeah, and he does all those things for Sunday Times Culture and The Guardian. And we're really, it's so nice to see you here in a non-ghoulish capacity.
It's vaguely ghoulish, isn't it? It's not to say that there aren't ghoulish elements to Fungus the Bogeyman.
We already know what this year's Halloween choice is going to be. And when we get to it, I'll tell you the choice was between the book we're doing today and the book we're doing in October. It's quite a dramatic difference.
Yeah, unlikely to be found on the same shelf. Okay, the book we're here to discuss, if you haven't already guessed, is Fungus the Bogeyman by Raymond Briggs, first published by Hamish Hamilton in 1977. The illustrated story of a working-class bogeyman undergoing an existential crisis about exactly what his night job of scaring dry cleaners, that's us humans, is for, became a huge international bestseller. As well as spawning merchandise of all shapes and sizes, of which more later, the book has been adapted for stage and twice for television, including a memorable BBC version in 2004, written by the novelist Mark Haddon, and most recently in a Sky 3-parter, starring Timothy Spall, Joe Scanlon, and Victoria Wood in her last television role. But before we sink knee-deep into the mulch and mould of bogeydom, Andy, what have you been reading this week?
Thank you very much. I've been reading a book called Laugh at Defiance by Mary Richardson, which is a memoir that was published in 1953. It's not in print. I had to get it out of the library in order to read it. And the reason I wanted to read it was that it's mentioned by artist and writer called Tom DeFreston in a new book called Wreck, which is published by Granta this month in March. It's about the painting The Raft of the Medusa by Jericho and various things that come off that painting. And I'm going to talk about it on a future episode of Backlisted. But in the course of this book, Tom DeFreston talks about something that happened on the 10th of March, 1914. On that date, Mary Richardson, who was a campaigner for women's suffrage, entered the National Gallery in London, produced an axe from up her sleeve, and broke the glass on Velasquez's painting, popularly known as the Rokeby Venus, and slashed it in five places. Wow. And she was restrained and arrested immediately, of course. And she issued this statement via the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU, which is the suffrage organisation popularly referred to as the Suffragettes. She said, "I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history."
Wow.
So that's what she did. And she caused a sensation, and she caused, amongst other things, single women were barred from being able to go into art galleries for some time after that.
What?
Because they were all considered suspects. And indeed, it is true that there was a spree of copycat vandalisms, destructions of artworks, following Mary Richardson's lead. Now, this is what she says. She's in the National Gallery. She's trying to find a moment where she can make her protest. "I went back to the Venus room. It looked peculiarly empty. There was a ladder lying against one of the walls, left there by some workmen who had been repairing a skylight. As 12 o'clock struck, one of the detectives rose from his seat and walked out of the room." There are a couple of guards protecting the painting. "The second detective, realising, I suppose, that it was lunchtime and he could relax, sat back, crossed his legs, and opened a newspaper. That presented me with my opportunity, which I was quick to seize. The newspaper held before the man's eyes would hide me for a moment. I dashed up to the painting. My first blow with the axe merely broke the protective glass, but of course it did more than that, for the detective rose with his newspaper still in his hand and walked round the red plush seat, staring up at the skylight, which was being repaired. The sound of the glass breaking also attracted the attention of the attendant at the door, who in his frantic efforts to reach me slipped on the highly polished floor and fell face downwards. And so I was given time to get in a further four blows with my axe before I was in turn attacked. It must all have happened very quickly, but to this day I can remember distinctly every detail of what happened. Two Baedeker guidebooks, truly aimed by German tourists, came cracking against the back of my neck." And then she's basically mobbed. A huge pile of people jumps on top of her, and the police come and get her, and she's taken off to Holloway, where she had been frequently before. I believe she is the suffragette to have been force-fed the most times.
Bloody hell. My God.
She suffered for the cause terribly.
Sounds amazing.
Right.
And it does sound amazing.
So that book was published in 1953, 40 years after the events it describes, 10 years before Mary Richardson's death. And in his book, Tonda Freston discusses what the meaning of that act might be, a protest for women's suffrage, or he tries to reclaim it as an artistic act. What is the meaning of the canvas with the slashes in it? You can see the photographs of it on the National Gallery website and on the internet. But he also says that later in her life, and this is something that is not mentioned by Mary Richardson in her autobiography at all, that in the 1920s, she stood for as a Labour Party candidate in a London election. She wasn't elected. And then in 1932, she joined the British Union of Fascists, led by Sir Oswald Mosley. And she said, quote, "I was first attracted to the black shirts because I saw in them the courage, the action, the loyalty, the gift of service and the ability to serve, which I had known in the suffragette movement." Okay, so I read the book and I thought, this is really interesting. If we're talking about who appropriates stories, whose story, who owns what story, is this a protest? Is it an artistic progress? Is it a protest against the male gaze? There's feminist criticism that sees Mary Richardson's attack on the painting as specifically about, she said later in life, I didn't like men gawping at women's bodies. She also said it was seen there was a financial value to the painting. We never attacked life. We attacked things that had value that would then attract the government's attention. And the book is a really carefully told and excellent, I must say, account of her struggle as a suffragette, her repeated imprisonment under the Cat and Mouse Act, her force feedings culminating in that act. So the painting is presented to you as the slashing of the painting is presented to you as the inevitable consequence of the psychological and physical torture she underwent. And that struck me as having contemporary relevance in two ways. First of all, how do we feel when we think about the different meanings that that act could have when we compare it with the toppling of John Cassady's statue of Edward Colston in Bristol? Mm-hmm. So it has a real contemporary resonance 100 years mm-hmm. later in terms of why people seek to take that kind of action, direct yeah. action. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, in the dangerous 21st century, despite whatever other meaning might be put on it, and despite the meaning that the author herself would like to present to you, it's quite difficult not to read this book as an account or chronicle of someone vulnerable to radicalization by a charismatic yeah. leader or leaders, either mm-hmm. the Pankhursts for the good or Oswald Mosley for the bad. Mm-hmm. She has a particular type of highly wound personality seeking strong leadership
yeah. that,
where she can get it, and a righteous cause, which history judges one to have been righteous, quite correctly, and the other quite correctly not to have been righteous. But I could almost see this book, I feel quite strongly the book ought to be republished with a very careful contextualization.
Yeah.
Like a sort of Edwardian Valerie Solanas, isn't it? That kind
yes.
of,
yeah. It's totally, totally fascinating book. Anyway, it's called Laugh of Defiance. Wow. John, what have you been reading this week?
Almost completely by contrast, although there is an overlap in that the bit I'm going to read from this marvellous short novel, which I've been reading, called Cold Enough for Snow by Australian writer Jessica Au, takes place in an art gallery. But there's, as you'll see, one of the joys of this book is that very little happens in it. It's 100 pages long. It's ostensibly about a mother and a daughter going on a holiday together to Japan. They go to art galleries, they eat in restaurants, they talk about the past. There isn't much capital P plot to go on. And yet, the word lapidary is perhaps overused about prose, but that's what you've got here. You've got 100 pages of the most yeah. beautiful descriptive. It's a novella. It's one story. It's not really, you know, it's that strange bit where a short story grows into something a little bit bigger. It's not clear by the end of the book, really, whether actually any of it has happened. Is the daughter actually just remembering the mother as a ghost? Are they really on holiday together? Is it all the same narrator all the way through? So I really, really loved this. I'm going to read a little bit. I'm not going to say much more about it, except to say that the thing that fiction does is open things up. At the point where the book is, you feel the narrator is going to have some profound insight. It flows through her fingers. But what happens by the end of the book, you find yourself going back and reading and rereading. It's a joy. It came through the post, thanks to Fitzcarraldo. I started reading it and I read 20 pages without being able to put it down. The prose is that good. So I'll read a little bit. This is the narrator and her mother. Her mother is from Hong Kong, Cantonese, from a Cantonese family. That's kind of important, although you know nothing really else about the narrator other than memories from her childhood. So they're finding a church in a Japanese Tokyo suburb. I had some trouble at first finding the church, but eventually we came across it, a low box-like building in a quiet neighborhood, and entered. Inside, the walls were made of raw concrete, which absorbed most of the light, making the interior dim and gray. The floor was not flat, but sloped ever so slightly downwards, as if pulling everything towards the simple southern altar. On the wall behind the altar, two great cuts had been made, one from floor to ceiling and the other horizontally, so that they resembled a giant cross. As we sat, all our attention was focused on this large shape and the brilliant white light that streamed through the gaps in contrast to the subdued atmosphere of the room. The effect was riveting, not unlike staring out at the daylight through the opening of a cave. And perhaps, I said to my mother, this too was what it had felt like to be in the earliest churches, when nature itself was still a force in the world, visceral and holy. I said also that the architect had originally intended the cross to be unsealed so that air and weather would have gusted through the openings like the will of God itself. It was a grey, cold day, and we were the only two people in the room. I asked my mother what she believed about the soul, and she thought for a moment. Then, looking not at me, but at the hard, white light before us, she said that she believed that we were all essentially nothing, just series of sensations and desires, none of it lasting. When she was growing up, she said that she'd never thought of herself in isolation, but rather as inextricably linked to others. Nowadays, she said, people were hungry to know everything, thinking they could understand it all, as if enlightenment were just around the corner. But she said, in fact, there was no control, and understanding would not lessen any pain. The best we could do in this life was to pass through it, like smoke through the branches, suffering until we either reached a state of nothingness or else suffered elsewhere. She spoke about other tenets of goodness and giving, the accumulation of kindness like a trove of wealth. She was looking at me then, and I knew that she wanted me to be with her on this, to follow her, but to my shame, I found that I could not, and worse, that I could not even pretend. Instead, I looked at my watch and said that visiting hours were almost over and that we should probably go. It's just a little snatch of it. It's
like
it's smoke, beautiful book.
Like smoke through the branches.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
It kind of never goes anywhere, but then it sort of does in a way that you don't stop thinking about it, which is, I think, honestly, what fiction is good at doing.
This is published by
Fitzcarraldo Editions. I'm afraid the big fat one last time, and this is a tiny little one. $9.99. It's okay. Cold Enough for Snow, Jessica Au.
The book chat will continue on the other side of this message.
This attic's full of memories for me. We spent all our summers by the seaside, and in winter, at home, by the fire. Frost on the window, and snow. Snowballs and making snowmen.
So we're here to talk about Fungus the Bogeyman, and Andrew, this was all your idea. And when you pitched it to us, just tell everyone what your one line was.
It's the children's anatomy of melancholy.
Yeah. Job done.
Just say that again for everybody.
It's the children's anatomy of melancholy.
That's the cornerstone of this episode. I think that is that is one of the greatest truths we have ever hit upon in Batlisted history. The children's anatomy of melancholy. That I had not read. John, I don't know how long it is since you read this book. I haven't read it for years. And it was not what I remembered it being at all.
No. I read it in the 70s, you know, when it came out, when I was, a mere strip of a lad myself. And remember enjoying it. And I remember the bogeyman fever that kind of overtook the world. But it's the force of revelation of reading it this time around and realizing that it is a meditation on it's a proper existential crisis that Fungus is having. It's a meditation on the modern world of such beauty and profundity. I'm absolutely amazed. I didn't read it again, but I'm really pleased. I've had the chance. Thank you to Nadia and Andrew for giving me the chance to reread it. Amazing.
Nadia, I would just like to make the point. Fungus the Bogeyman has all the poos and farts that we would expect to find in much contemporary children's literature.
Yeah.
But also massive intellectual content that we perhaps would not find in much contemporary children's literature. So my memory of it, I don't know what your memory of it is, but my memory of it was that people were scandalized by the rudeness of it.
Yeah.
Whereas in fact, going back to it, it's just the as Andrew identifies, the elements like Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, which seems surprising in a work for children.
I'm not convinced I actually sat down and read the whole thing when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I know that I was aware of Fungus the Bogeyman. I'm pretty sure I had like a Fungus the Bogeyman stationery set. I'm pretty sure, you know, because the The typeface, yeah. The fonts, you know, the hand-drawn Fungus the Bogeyman writing on the cover, that's very familiar to me. The character's familiar to me. When I was reading the book, I was like, did I ever actually sit down and read this? Because I'm not sure I did.
Yeah.
If I'm being, you know, truthful.
Yeah, I would say that's probably fairly common.
You do get a lot of bogeys and farts and poos in kids' books now. But this was kind of a revolutionary book in that respect.
Yeah.
Because that hadn't really happened much before this. And, you know, Raymond Briggs had the kind of stature and he could go for it. Also, you've got to remember the number of author illustrators working in the country at that time compared to now, radically different.
Yeah,
there's a huge range now of books and authors, and there's something for every taste pretty much. But back then, it was these giants, of these art school giants who'd kind of gone through the art school system at kind of the same stage. So, you know, you've got Brian Wildsmith and then, you know, Raymond Briggs, various other contemporaries, but there was quite a small number.
Mm.
I was amazed by how dense the text was. There's so much text and it's so crammed in.
Sort of book you would dip into as a child. I think you would open like a double page spread and then you would kind of lose yourself in it, right? I mean, we must ask Andrew. Andrew, you've got your original copy there, haven't you? When did you get your copy?
Aww.
In 1977, my brother bought it for me for my birthday. And it's interesting, kind of, I was having a conversation recently on Twitter, of course, about things that I thought were too young for me in 1977, which included Star Wars. I didn't go to see Star Wars because I was too grown up for Star Wars. And 2008 AD magazine. 2008 AD magazine came out in 1977. I didn't buy it because it looked silly and I thought I was far too grown up for it. However, I did not think that I was too grown up for Fungus the Bogeyman, and neither did my brother who bought it for me. And I actually think 11 is the right age at which to read Fungus the Bogeyman, because I completely got lost in the text and the denseness of it. And what's interesting about it, I mean, just as an aside, I went back and looked at the TV adaptations, and the thing that they get wrong about it is that it's noisy. It's got like burps and farts in it and everything. And the thing that you notice about going back to Fungus the Bogeyman is how quiet and contemplative it is. You know, it's about thought and it's about an immersion in silence.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that when John was talking about the plot, you know, you've basically got this kind of discontented working class man railing against the system and pondering the meaning of his existence. And then his wife tells him not to worry and it'll all be fine and it doesn't really help. And that's the end of it. And you kind of think, well, that's kind of the sort of stories, the books that Briggs was growing up with, the kind of angry young man books by the likes of sort of David Story and Alan Sillitoe. They're basically this kind of man, working class man, railing against the system, but he still has his, you know, his tea on the table when he gets home.
Yeah,
it's also the plot of all his other books as well. I mean, all Briggs books are about
discontent working men who think there must be more to life than this, including, of course, Father Christmas. But one of the interesting things about it, going back to it, is at the time I loved the language and the kind of depth of language. But realizing now and having the internet and the chance to look it up and realize that he's quoting people like John Milton. I mean, all the poetry and the literature that's quoted in there is people like Thomas Carlyle, John Milton, Edmund Burke.
John Donne.
And John Donne. And so I'm reading about this stuff and basically kind of reading about Robert Herrick's book Hesperides. And that is basically about, it's a picaresque guide to the history and weather and people and customs of the Isle. And you realize that that's what Briggs is doing. He's writing his own, he's writing the bogey version of Hesperides, and all those jokes are in there. And it's so rich.
So, Andrew, are you saying it's plop driven rather than plot driven?
Oh, very good. Very good.
I think we should hear from Raymond Briggs. We've got a few bits to hear from Raymond, who is a wonderful... we've been so lucky this year. Some of the writers we've featured are also brilliant conversationalists, and that's very true of Raymond Briggs. Here he is, setting the tone on Desert Island Discs with Ray Plumley in 1983.
Raymond, how would you view a spell as a Robinson Crusoe? Oh, I think I'd look forward to it, really. I'm a bit fed up with all the things we have to deal with every day, like paperwork and telephones and form filling.
How important is music in your life?
Not very much. I'm not a great music fan. I've always found it rather complicated and technical and rather intimidating.
Do you have any skill? Do you play any instrument?
No, nothing at all. Never have.
Do you play music while you're working?
No, I listen to Radio 4 more than anything. Mm. I play music in the evenings between about 6 and 8, I think. Mainly cheer-upping sort of music, such as I've chosen.
That's the time when you feel you want to be cheered up at the end of the day rather than the beginning.
Yes,
despite the fact you've done a good day's work.
Yes. Relief of the gloom that descends at that time when the day's all gone badly.
Oh.
I love him.
Raymond.
I love him.
And that's the start of the show. They haven't even played a record yet.
It's
wonderful.
You want to say, Raymond, you do know what this show is about.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this is classic Raymond Briggs. On that one, on the 1983 one, he plays 8 red-hot jazz records in a row. Yeah. Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful jazz music.
He loved jazz.
And then when he comes back in 2005, he chooses a whole different palette of types of music. Totally, wow. Totally fascinating. So we talked a bit about how Fungus the Bogeyman doesn't have a plot. And Nadja, you said you don't think you read it as a child. Can you remember, what's the earliest Raymond Briggs book you can remember, or the presence of Raymond Briggs?
I remember, well, I came out a year after Fungus the Bogeyman, so maybe my age has something to do with it, so to speak. I remember The Snowman kind of being in my childhood. I remember the book, and I remember, obviously, well, I think the animation might have been 1980. I'm going to get this wrong. I'm going to guess it's 83-ish, maybe. 83, 84, when The Snowman animation came out, and it was just a snowman explosion. So that would have been the first time I was aware of him.
John, I don't know about you. My mum wouldn't buy me Father Christmas by Raymond Briggs because it was too rude. It was considered too shocking at the time.
Yeah. I had to read Father Christmas in the library. I remember getting The Snowman, it would have been a year or 2 years afterwards, and being massively disappointed in it.
Right.
Because it had no words, it had no text. What is this shit?
Oh, no appreciation. No appreciation of the visual narrative, Andrew. Come on, the sequential image.
No, it brought out the Greil Marcus in me. It was literally, I was looking at it going, what is this shit? And More text, more dense quoting, more misery, more existential doubt, please. Yeah.
I'm always on the back foot with these sorts of things because people assume, because I'm a picture book maker, they always assume like, oh, when you were a child, did your parents read to you? Did you have a wealth of picture books in the house? And the truth is no, we had no picture books in the house. So I don't have the well-thumbed kind of sentimental pile of picture books that loads of my contemporaries do. But my parents are Pakistani immigrants. Culturally, it just wasn't a thing, I don't think, back then. It was just different now.
I've got the Hamish Hamilton paperback here. It cost £1.95. And on the back, it doesn't have any blurb. It just has review quotes. It says, a super book, Daily Mirror, a revolting book, Evening Standard. A very decent book indeed, BBC Kaleidoscope. You need a strong stomach and a quick eye, Sunday Times. Exquisite perversity, Quentin Crisp. That's what you want.
Yeah. I want that on all my books.
Yeah. So here's Raymond Briggs talking again in 1983 about the relationship between writing Fungus the Bogeyman and then The Snowman.
Albert Ammon's Boogie Rocks.
Raymond, the complaints about Father Christmas on the lavatory were as nothing to the complaints that flowed in about Fungus the Bogeyman.
Yes. Again, the kids didn't complain at all. It's these other peculiar people who find it disgusting and can't see what's behind it. They only see the superficialities, I think.
Well, the hideous world of bogeydom, slime, pus, mildew, mould, you name it, it's all there in a rather off shade of green.
Yes, but it seems fairly natural to me. I don't find it horrifying at all. It's all part of everyday life. And I don't know why people object to it so much.
Well, the children didn't seem to object, as you say. You sold, what, 50,000 copies in a year?
I never know the figures, actually. No,
that's
I don't
the one
know.
I've got.
Really? Oh, that's good.
After Fungus the Bogeyman, the horror, you went on to The Snowman, which was really sweetness and light all the way through.
Well, that was done in reaction to Fungus. I'd spent 2 years doing Fungus, all immersed in this snot and slime and muck and everything. I was a bit fed up with it, also with the wordiness of it. And I wanted to do something that was quieter and simpler, with no words, and relatively quick to do. And I turned to The Snowman as light relief from The Bogeyman, really.
Yeah, Andrew. Perfect.
But he did just... yeah. But what's... we'll talk about this in a minute, but Nadja, all the interviews that Briggs gives, he's very... that persona is brilliant, because what he always says when he's asked, why did you write your own pitch books? He says, well, I realised that it was... You know, I was being asked to illustrate texts that were terrible, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, it's much easier to be a writer than an illustrator. I might as well just write my own stuff, which I think is
I've got to be...
a fascinating,
I've got to be careful what I say now.
But it's a fascinating bit of blood. I mean, more in terms of Raymond Briggs himself. It's a really interesting persona he puts forward that you'll hear all the way through this. That is a brilliant example of someone pretending to be somebody for the purposes of going out and talking about their work.
Completely.
Don't you think?
I absolutely agree. I wonder how much of his. I'm sure he was quite. Grumpy individual in many ways, but I wonder how much of that was a kind of camouflage for shyness, social awkwardness, and also when he talks himself down as a writer, I wonder if that's a defense mechanism. He is a writer. There's no doubt when you're reading his books, you know, the way he uses language, his ear for dialogue. We'll talk later on about Ethel and Ernest, which is, you know, speech bubbles. It's all dialogue, but you don't just toss that off, you know. He's not just plonking words in. But it's interesting. Maybe he felt more confident being regarded because he went through art school. I think he went to Slade. Maybe he felt more confident being regarded as an artist and didn't want to be judged as a writer. I don't know. I'm speculating, but that, as you say, that kind of mask he puts on, that being I may as well get paid for the words as well.
I
think concealing some insecurities, maybe.
He writes so beautifully.
John, could you give us a bit of...
Yeah, I will. And this is, there's a thing about him that I never, until you were just saying that, Nadja, he was kind of a hero for what we would now call neurodiverse people. Quietness, visual, you know, that I think, you know, he was an introvert. He didn't like socializing. He didn't want to be forced into the limelight. Didn't want to talk about his work. But I'll just read a little bit about Bogey Ball, because it's one of the best things about sport ever written, I think. Bogey Ballers are so wrapped up. It's a wonder they can move at all. Yet despite this, and the layer of filth, they seem to move with an effortless grace and dignity, which makes the fussy scurrying about of surface footballers appear slightly ridiculous. The bogey ball is much larger than a football, being 31 inches in diameter and of an extremely light nature, more like a balloon than a ball. Bogeymen seem to be entirely lacking in the competitive spirit, for the object of the game is to put the ball into the player's own goal and help the opposing team to put the ball into their goal. The aim is to lose the game, that is, to score the fewest goals. This is quite difficult when the opposing team is helping you to score. Bogeymen are shy, gentle and retiring by nature, so there is no physical contact between them in their games. Should two players accidentally bump into one another, they will immediately step back and bow formally, emitting a quiet hiss at the same time. In bogey ball, the ball is passed gently from one player to another, more often with the head than the feet. For this reason, bogey ballers wear bogey ball bonnets, which are flat-topped hats designed not to protect their heads, but to protect the ball from damage by the bogeyman's little horns. Bogeymen never run or hurry, not even in their games, so the match proceeds with an almost dreamlike slow motion. There is no shouting or cheering. The crowd expresses its approval with a quiet hissing. A goal is greeted with complete silence and stillness. Many spectators instantly fall asleep. The strange and unnerving silence which follows a bogey goal is a memorable event to anyone who has ever experienced it.
That's just beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, Nadja, you're right. What brilliant writing.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah. And what he's done, he does that thing. He inverts the inversion thing is that's which is runs through the book. It's just beautifully done there.
I think Roman may have the same opinion of football as Andy.
I could relatable, Nikki. It's relatable. Andrew, you compared it to The Anatomy of Melancholy. I wonder, did you feel going back to it that the depths of the book are, you know, the surface of it is the love of language and the jokes. But beneath it, there's deep currents of learning and gloom, I suppose I would characterise it. It seemed to me so green and boggy for what's nominally a children's book.
One of the lovely things about it is, in the same way that he presents bogey facts, like there are pages from encyclopedias and it's a question of sort of learning, that's kind of how it's presented to you, that you are in a process of learning and you're deep within knowledge. And it kind of mentioning kind of when we were saying earlier that he quotes from people like kind of Carlyle and Milton and everything, but not only does he quote from them, he borrows the structures of a lot of their books, you know, so you can compare it to Burke's Philosophical Inquiry into the Sublime, or, you know, you can compare it to Carlyle's Sartre or Resartus. You know, these are, you know, obviously I didn't pick up on that when I was 11, but, you know, you go back to it now and you can see kind of the erudition and the knowledge.
Surprised.
I mean, even that was by the time I got, I was 12 by the time I twigged it. but, you know, there's like that lovely passage about the National Bogey Gallery, which you kind of realize is about, it's kind of Briggs writing about Victorian art, you know, and kind of, a lot of the time you feel that he's writing a kind of history book about, you know, almost like a past age. There's a nostalgia in there and there's a kind of sentimentality that, you know, in the sense that he's kind of writing about, yes, he's writing about bogeydom, but he's also writing about this kind of, he's writing with a sense of nostalgia for it, of something that's gone. Which is incredibly moving, incredibly beautiful.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Why don't we hear? So the audio quality on this isn't very good, but it is totally fascinating. This is Raymond Briggs talking in 1980 about Fungus the Bogeyman. And the background noise you can hear in the second half is him referring to a filing cabinet. You can find this on YouTube, stuffed with the research for Fungus the Bogeyman. When he opens the drawer, it's broken up with dividers saying things like culture and slime. And so the reading that has gone into the book is clearly immense.
Having got the character coming into the thing, I worked with the dictionary a lot, because I always work from the words and from the literary side of things. And I spent a long time going through the dictionary making lists of words which either sounded bogeyish or could be turned into bogeyish stuff. And started a whole filing cabinet drawer of stuff, because most of the things, when you publish something, only a fraction of what you actually do gets into the book. Appearance and anatomy, what they look like, flora and fauna and big section on slime, bogey buildings, shops, clothes and equipment, literature, all this stuff. And the bogey glossary was the main thing. List of words which were used, list of which didn't get in the end. Cupid and blanket and boglet. And muckender was quite an interesting one. That's an 18th century word for handkerchief, which is quite a good word for it, because it's where all the muck ends up. So muckender is a good word for that. And huge amount of stuff which doesn't actually get into the book at all, but helps you to build up the thing in your mind so you can make it a bit more convincing.
Fantastic.
I mean, I'm sorry about the quality, but that's the best I could get it.
It's brilliant.
But totally exactly what we've all been saying, you know, the depth of work that goes into creating the world. Now, we asked everybody to bring, in addition to Fungus the Bogeyman, their favourite Raymond Briggs book. Nadia, which book did you choose?
Well, I've chosen Ethel and Ernest, which is a long-form comic strip. Some people would say graphic novel to make it sound respectable. whatever you want to call it, graphic novel, long-form comic. And it's about his parents, Ethel and Ernest. It spans their relationship from, you know, their early courtship, the moment they first meet, all the way up to their deaths. It's so, so beautiful. And I think for me, it kind of distills the things that I love the most about his work. And I respond, I don't know why, but I just respond to his illustration style in this book a lot more than I actually do with Fungus the Bogeyman, for example, or the Snowman. Yeah. There's something about how he observes, kind of the fabric of everyday life, the light switches and lampshades, the bricks of the house that he grows up in.
Steve Bell, the Guardian cartoonist, says one of the great things about Raymond Briggs's work is his ability to draw bricks, tiles, and slates.
Yes, it is, because he does it. I am useless at this. I think that's one of the reasons I'm so in awe of him. I consider myself just this. I am a terrified amateur, but when it comes to buildings and. He draws every brick sort of has soul and he draws every line and every tile is imbued with feeling and you can feel it absolutely. And smell it. And it's that, you know, so aside from the story, the kind of narrative and the dialogue, which is fantastic. Aside from all of that, I'm just, you know, in awe of the drawings. They're just so beautifully, perfectly observed. You know that he knows this house inside and out.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are some images towards the end as his parents are declining in health, which just take your breath away.
They're heartbreaking, yeah, yeah.
The kind of raw emotional nakedness of some of the images at the end. You know, I really was having to, you know, have a few deep breaths. when you get there, because it's so moving.
There's something quite Larkin-esque about Ethel and Ernest.
Andrew, and also, yeah, that's right, the Larkin-esque, but also you see his parents throughout his work, don't you?
As we
look back on his work. So this is specifically about his parents, but where else do we find a couple who are like his mother and father to Andrew?
Well, of course, it's in Fungus the Bogeyman as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And in When the Wind Blows as well, of course.
And When the Wind Blows. But that thing I want to say about the Larkin thing, it's kind of because of, it's about that eye for detail that Nadia talks about, but it's also about his fascination with the banal and the poetry of the banal. And that's in Fungus the Bogeyman, and it's in Ethel and Ernest as well. And just that sense that he finds things of interest in aspects that we would look past. And he looks at the bogey world like that, like, you know, the little, you know, depressions in the earth where the bogeys go to sleep and dream when things get too difficult for them, which I'm quite envious of.
I know, I want one of those.
Exactly. But also, you know, he does that with Ethel and Ernest. He says in interviews, you know, there's nothing very much happened in their lives. But that is the point that he's making, that you can take a story about two ordinary people. And if you've got the right eye for detail, you can find the beauty in it and you can find the poignancy in it.
Here's a little bit of Raymond talking about the influence of his parents on his work. And also, I just must tell people that in the second half of this clip, he's referring to some furniture that he's painted in his own house with a portrait of his mother and father, of Ethel and Ernest.
I mean, the one I like best is my mum and dad one, of course, Ethel and Ernest. Seem to be obsessed with my parents, got 500 photographs of them up on the wall and drawings and things. Very unhealthy. I do look at it quite often. It's the only one of my books I ever do look at, because it's like a family picture book in a way. I don't look at the death bits at the end, of course. That's a bit upsetting. This was done while I was filling in time, I think. I waited to hear what they said about Ethel and Ernest. When I'd drawn it out in pencil, and they were ages looking at it. So I filled in the time doing this sort of knitting, just doing my parents again. just to pass the time, really. And I never finished it. It's so crude and unfinished and bad in all sorts of ways. But I've ceased to see it now. I might paint it over soon because it's rather ghastly. It's a bit like those people at the Bloomsbury lot, you know. Decorated covered doors. Atrociously. Yes, that's what it is, really. Yet another parental thing.
Oh, he's so wonderful.
Oh, how wonderful. Oh, he's so wonderful.
So I would like to talk very briefly. I'd just like to give a shout out to one of his later books, which I found I'd never read before with a prep for this. It's just brilliant. Have any of you read Ugh, Boy Genius of the Stone Age?
No.
I haven't actually, no.
Oh, it's so funny. It's so funny. And like The Anatomy of Melancholy, Andrew, it has loads of footnotes in it.
Oh, this sounds good.
It's all one song, as we're fond of saying on here, but it's the same story again. It's about a Stone Age boy called Ugh, who is sensitive and a visionary and has the misfortune to have parents who aren't, called Doug and Dougs. His mum is called Dougs. and he dreams of having trousers that aren't made of stone. That's the plot. The plot, he said, these trousers are too small, Dad. I wish trousers weren't made of stone. They're so uncomfortable, I can hardly move. And Doug, his dad, says, they were made for you by me, hand-carved trousers. And Ugh says, why can't trousers be made of something else, something softer? And his father says, softer? Look, there's nothing in the world except mud, bushes and stones. So take your pick. What do you want? Trousers made of mud? Trousers made of bushes? Listen to me. Nowadays, everything is made of stone. That's why it's called the Stone Age.
Brilliant.
No spoilers in this, but even by the standards of Raymond Briggs, the ending of this one is absolutely bleak beyond all imagining. I can't actually, I don't want to say what it is because it would spoil the reading, but it's such a little pathetic drop at the end of the book. They get so close to making soft trousers. That's all I'm going to say. In keeping with so many of Raymond Briggs's books, they have sad endings. And here's a bit of Raymond talking about that now.
Your children's books don't always have happy endings, do they?
No, they're usually sad endings, people tell me. But most endings are sad anyway. It all ends in death. Snowman melts. And the bear goes back to the Arctic and everyone dies at the end when the wind blows.
Well, quite. But you think that's important?
Yes, absolutely. Because that's what we've all got to face.
That's the reality. And Father Christmas, according to you, is a grumpy old what's it?
Well, it's bound to be. It's only being logical. And we know if you treat it logically, all these things I do, you take something that's fantastical, like a bogeyman, Father Christmas, and from then on assume that they're real, and from then on treat it completely logically.
So Father Christmas gets cheesed off getting dirty and coming down the chimney. And
dreadful job. I mean, we know he's old. We know he's fat. Who'd like to climb down one chimney, let alone hundreds, covered in soot, freezing cold, on your own? Dreadful, dreadful job. He's bound to be fed up with it.
Are you telling me you're a grumpy old man?
No. I'm very cheerful and light-hearted.
So lovely.
I think it's interesting what he says there. He is truthful. He doesn't shy away from the truth. I mean, you know, even with Fundus the Bogeyman, you know, bogeys and all the other unpleasantness, that's very true. That's a true part of being human. And he knows that children haven't yet really learned to, or I think he does. I don't think he's that concerned with his audience, actually. But I think he recognises that children also just look at the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, oh, we die at the end. Okay,
it's like,
I think
in children's books, I've put death in some of my children's books, and it's adults who get upset. It's adults who write angry reviews on Amazon about me, or who will send an angry email. It's not children.
Adults are closer to death. You see, they're more scared of it.
Yeah.
But it's funny because, I mean, the book he wrote, The Man, which feels very much like a kind of reaction to The Snowman, but
that's
also
amazing too.
A reaction to, I think also a reaction to books like The Tiger Came to Tea, because it's basically about this kind of horrible little homunculus who comes to live with this boy. And he's an absolute nightmare and he's miserable and he just messes everything up and just kind of is a burden to the young boy. And then leaves, you know, and it's kind of like you think, is he writing about, you know, young people looking after their old parents? You know, is he kind of, is it another reference to Briggs's own life? But it's a brilliant way of doing it. It basically says, you know, that these people might come into your life, and unlike the snowman, which is a magical event that ends in it melting, the arrival into your life could be an absolute sod.
Yeah, they bicker. They spend the whole book bickering, and at the end, he misses him terribly. It's just a marriage incredible. Story again, surely.
Yes. Yeah, he just and he kind of creates some. Oh, yes, fantastic.
John, what book have you brought to us?
I brought this. It's called Notes from the Sofa, and it's a collection.
And this
of
is the book you published, right?
We published this. Unbound published it. He apparently heard Dan, my partner, business partner, on the radio, and he said, "I hear you giving publishing a kick up the arse. How can I help?"
Wow.
Dan and James Pembroke from the Oldie, and Raymond had a marvellous old school boozy lunch. We had several of those after that. And it's basically his columns, but it's, you know, the columns are sometimes ranty, but they're very, very funny. And they are, of course, also heartbreaking. I mean, the last column is about the death of his dog. He writes about the death of his chicken, where he falls in love with this chicken that adopts him. But I just thought I'm not going to read very much, but there's just a brilliant little story in here, which this is classic Roman Briggs, right? He says, almost half a century ago, became a friend of the great Kay Webb, founder of Puffin Books, and known affectionately in the trade as Big Fat Puffin. I didn't know that was true, but that's if Roman's Crikey. Saying it's true. So my wife Jean had, this is great, you know, you talk about those sort of focus pulls he's able to do. My wife Jean had died in 1973, and Kay kindly took me under her wing, as I had no family, something you desperately need at such a time. My parents had both died in 1971, and I had no brothers and sisters. Anyway, they go on this mad tour to Norfolk, and they end up being locked out of their hotel, and they have to sleep in his van, in his car. They go into the reception and say, what the hell was going on? And they say, well, did you not see the signs? The hotel closes at 11:30 p.m. And he writes this, whoever heard of a hotel closing at 11:30 p.m.? It makes you want to bring back hanging. Kay was over 60 at the time, and an October night spent virtually outdoors could have had serious consequences for her health. Newspaper headlines might have read, Ronald Searle's ex-wife frozen in van. a 39-year-old van driver, that's him, has been arrested. Anything for a quiet life in solitary. Anyway, it's just a lovely, lovely collection. But he was a total joy to deal with. Everybody fell in love with him. And, you know, it's still in print, still obviously sells really, really well. It was, just one of the great publishing experiences.
Wow. So I hadn't appreciated until we were researching for this that, in fact, basically all the books we think of as Raymond Briggs, from Father Christmas onwards from the early 1970s, are in reaction to his personal situation in the early 70s, where he lost both parents and his wife in the space of a year. And I think when you know that, and also the fact that he was in his late 30s to early 40s, all this huge success that came to him was almost not irrelevant. It clearly made things more comfortable, but secondary to the exploration artistically of what those losses meant to him. And so before we talk about that, and we talk about his what will probably be his final book, I think we should hear him talk about his wife, Jean.
She has schizophrenia, which is not something that I wish on anybody. Absolute nightmare. But that governed our whole lives, governed her life, of course, and governed mine for many years. She was constantly in and out of mental hospitals. Yeah. Mm.
But you've also said that she was an inspiration as well in her meanderings, as it were, sometimes.
Yes, well, they are very inspiring people because they have wild flights of imagination and tremendous enthusiasms and excitement and very stimulating to live with, if exhausting. But you have all the bad side of it, the agoraphobia, claustrophobia, and physical attacks, rather like epilepsy, to cope with. Mm. Lying on the bed and shuddering and screaming. It's all rather alarming, really. Mm. The burden was for her more than for me. Mine was just helping to look after and to deal with it.
What did she die of in the end, then?
Leukemia. Mm. Had both these things going at the same time, leukemia and schizophrenia. I wrote an attempt at a poem about it when she was in hospital. These two things ravaging this person. There we are.
Nadia, you were talking about truth.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very hard to listen to that and not respect his willingness to deal with these dreadful things in his art and in his life.
It's unflinching and yet unsentimental. He refuses to give in to that sentimentality, doesn't he? I think that's how he honours them, whether it's his gene or his parents. He honours them by representing them completely wholly and speaking about gene completely truthfully. I think that's his, that's his tribute to them.
And he would probably disagree with you saying this, but in that context, it's very easy to look at his books as a kind of therapy, isn't it? And a kind of a way of working through ideas and thoughts and kind of, you know, and they are kind of all, they're ruminations on existence, aren't they? They're about brief lives, and they're about people who come to stay and then leave suddenly.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think when you pull, I mean, I think people working in the field of children's books and picture books, and I'm not comparing everyone to Raymond Briggs, but I do think a lot of that happens in the form. I do think any author illustrator worth their salt or who means it or cares about the form will put some of their own stuff in there, and it will not be noticed by anyone, or, you know, maybe not even them. But it will be in there, and certainly for someone of Raymond Briggs's kind of, you know, caliber, that's hugely the case.
I think he had that thing of, spending time with him. You know, there was a lot of bravura, but that one skin too few thing. Mm. He reminded me in lots of ways of Alan Garner in that respect. Very different kind of work, but they were both the war, you know, loomed over their lives in such a huge way. And, you know, both of them, I suppose, as you say, it's not the way he would have described it, but they use their art to cope with the fact that they feel things so deeply that they have to make it, they have to leaven it with humour. They have, but actually, you know, as we've said, Raymond's books are not, they're comedy in the kind of, you know, in that sort of Shakespearean, Beckettian sense. You know, they're not comedy in the kind of slapstick sense at all. I mean, they're very, very deep and quite dark.
I agree, Johnny. I mean, for me, going back and revisiting or visiting both those things, Raymond Briggs's work for this, my understanding of him as an artist in the true sense, I don't mean just someone who draws things. I mean, as an artist, you know, that someone who draws on in their 40s, 50s and the rest of their life, the things that matter to them, the particular things that matter to them, they come back to them again and again to present universal ways of looking at them. And that's what art is, it seems to me.
How moving is that final hug in Fungus? The slimy hug in that. I mean, where it's about love, you know. It's just that she's loving him through his existential kind of doubt. It's just beautiful.
Could we talk a little bit before we go about his most recent and what will probably be his final book? This was published in 2019 by Jonathan Cape. It's called Time for Lights Out. I didn't really know about this book, and I read it for backlisted, and I think everyone else did, didn't they? I think we all kind of...
we did.
As much as I could bear. Yeah.
I was absolutely blown away by this. This seems to me to be a fantastic example of a forgotten book published in 2019. And weirdly, what we're here for, to draw people's attention to. I mean, you probably know Fungus the Bogeyman, listeners, and you probably don't know Time for Lights Out. But it's the product of 20 years' work. It's the book Briggs said he was writing for years about old age. And it is the... I can't find the vocabulary. I've never read a book like it. There you go. I've never read a book like Time for Lights Out. What did everybody else think of it?
I thought it was incredible. And the thing that struck me immediately is how similar to Fungus the Bogeyman is. And a lot of his books, but finally he is writing about himself. He is, he is finally the character at the center of the book. He's no longer using Father Christmas or Fungus the Bogeyman. It is about Raymond Briggs, but it's following the same path. It's that it addresses all those things like a quest for meaning. You see parallels in the way that kind of he is someone who kind of thinks about poetry and prose and kind of is incredibly learned, but is constantly confronting the questions that other people don't. So like Fungus is asking, what is the point? Why are we here? And Mildew and his pals down the pub don't want to address it. And right up until the present day, he is on that final path that he talks about. And he's asking those questions that even people at his age would not dare ask about their own existence.
No, what about the way the art and the text interact in this book?
Well, I mean, that's what I was going to say, is that I find that fascinating, that, you know, that the artwork is black and white pencil scattered throughout the book. It's not particularly consistent. Occasionally there'll be a comic strip. Sometimes there'll just be some scrawled quick drawings that he's just, you know, sort of some light sketches. But I think that kind of speaks to what Andrew was just saying. He's stripped away the need to have the kind of world building of Fungus the Bogeyman, where these themes are weaved beautifully within this colourful, sludgy, but still colourful comic. That is really stripped away, and everything is just, the information is being laid down as he needs, almost, I know it took 20 years, but it feels quite quick.
Yeah.
Almost like he's just trying to get everything down, what he really feels about every interaction, whether it's a passage about his dad dying. He wants to takes us there exactly to the bedside, and you know, all his thoughts, like, get on with it, dad, and then he got on with it. So he's getting rid of anything extraneous and getting it all down.
But at the same time, that light pencil gives you the feeling that it could all just blow away. That there's a real sense of
impermanence.
There's a real sense of impermanence about it, that we are at the end and it's only just staying on the page, and it's utterly delicate.
Amazing, amazing book. I just want to read one poem from it, which seems like Raymond Briggs wrote as an epitaph, talking about the house that he lived in, that we've talked about, talking about maybe the attic that we heard David Bowie at the beginning in, with reminiscing about the snowman. This is a poem from Time for Lights Out called Future Ghosts. Looking round this house, what will they say, the future ghosts? There must have been some balmy old bloke here, long-haired, artsy-fartsy type, did pictures for kiddie books or some such tripe. You should have seen the stuff he stuck up in that attic. Snowman this and snowman that, tons and tons of tat. 3 skips it took, and a whopping bonfire out the back. Thank God it's gone. And he's gone too. He must have been a nutter through and through. And if that's not bravery, listeners, I don't know what is.
I'm afraid it's now time for our lights out. Large and moist thanks to Andrew and Nadia for reminding us of the melancholy wit of Raymond Briggs. To Nikki Birch, for producing a bogey-friendly hiss of a show, and to Unbound for the supplies of soggies and cloaca cola.
You can download all 157 previous episodes, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website, backlisted.fm. We're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook, and now in sound and pictures on Instagram too.
You can also show your love directly by supporting our Patreon at www.patreon.com/backlisted. We aim to survive without paid for advertising, and your generosity helps us do that. All patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early, and for little more than the price of two pots of green slime at the King Orgeus, lot listeners get two extra lot listeds a month. Our own public liberality, where we three give vent to our libidinous natures and discuss the dross we've heard, watched and read in the previous fortnight.
Oh, dear. Lock listeners also get to hear their names read out on the show as a mark of our thanks and appreciation.
This week's batch roll call is Yasmin Awad, Stuart Galloway-Walker and Charlotte Geeta. Thank you all for your generosity. All our patrons,
thank you.
Our heartfelt thanks.
Thank
enabling
you so
us to
much.
Continue what we do and love and enjoy.
Narja Shireen, is there anything you would like to add about Raymond Briggs that we have yet to say? Any last message for our listeners?
Well, do you know a nice thing that happened? I have this huge pile of Raymond Briggs books in my living room, and my nine-year-old, wandered past and went, Raymond Briggs, blooming Christmas, and wandered off.
Brilliant.
So I was really heartened by that. I thought it continues. The power continues.
Very good.
Wonderful. Andrew, really only our longest term listeners will understand why I'm asking you this, but if Fungus the Bogeyman were a Gene Kelly film, which Gene Kelly film would it be?
You won't be surprised to hear that I had to dig quite deep for this one. But in 1962, Gene Kelly directed a film called Zizho, in which Jackie Gleason plays a giant, unwashed, sentimental mute who travels the foul-smelling back streets of Paris and tries to explain concepts like death, religion, and war to a small, questioning child.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Nikki, can we drop in the end of the 1812 overture to salute Andrew's achievement there? Magnificent, Andrew, magnificent.
That's superb.
Thank you.
Listen,
superb.
Thanks very much, everybody. We're going to leave you with a tribute that I think Raymond would hate, which has been, recorded by our dear friend, Verity McCormack, who is 8 years old, and you'll recognise the poem. So thanks very much, Nadja, Andrew. This has been
brilliant.
Wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
Boy, boy, Dreas.
Boy, boy, Dreas.
Future ghosts. Looking around this house, what will they say, the future ghosts? There must have been some barnyard bloke here.
Long-haired, artsy-fartsy type. The pictures for kiddie books or some such tripe.
You should have seen the stuff he stuck up in that attic. Snowman this, snowman that, tons and tons and tons of tat. Three skips it took and a whopping bonfire out the back. Thank God it's gone, and he's gone too. He must have been a real mutter, through and through.
Do you like children?
Well, not our mess. I mean, occasionally you come across kids who are nice and you get on with them as individuals. As a species, I suppose I don't, really.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Lock Listed, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.